Welcome, everyone. Welcome, everybody, and welcome to today's edition of Late Night with Deanne on the Deanne Burley Show. And we're here on Blog Talk Radio. We're also on a phone show. We're on KU Band, and welcoming everybody to the broadcast. And we've got a lot of things to talk about here on the show tonight. In future shows, we're going to be jamming up the airwaves with programs all week long. I'm on from 5 p.m. Central Standard Time now on the Micro Effect radio broadcast. Started last week and getting a hang of it, and we're going to start really bringing the program back up to speed on the Micro Effect. And please tune in to there. You can get it through going to my site, which is the Burley website, like www.dmburleyshow.com. You go there and you can listen in, just click on. We're on that first hour. The second hour from 6 to 7 p.m. Central Time, we are on broadcast Truth Radio and Blog Talk Radio, Simulcast. That's Monday through Friday at 6 to 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. We're on again at 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Central Standard Time, Monday through Friday, with a Blog Talk Radio broadcast, simulcast with Now Live. Then later on in the evening at 11 o'clock, we're going to be introducing programs with Mo. He's from Iran. He's going to be giving Middle Eastern viewpoints and information on. So look for that broadcast. We're going to have the Homeless Radio broadcast going. We have also another gentleman that's going to be on involved during these broadcast weeks dealing with the veterans. And we're going to have a jam-packed schedule, including entertainment and more. So look to all these things coming under the Deanne Burley name, and you're going to hear a lot of good things happening around. Also, if you want to go to my website, again, it's www.deanneburleyshow.com. If you want to write me, it's deanne.burley@gmail.com, deanne.burley@gmail.com. Write to me at 3150 Finley Road in Downers Grove, Illinois, 60515, suite number 310. Again, we need your donations and help to keep these broadcasts going. We're trying to get as much information out there to you. And if you're interested in coming on board, helping with broadcasts and things, have equipment that you would like to donate, and we can help, need help with donations, please do so through PayPal by just going to deanne.burley@gmail.com. Now, I'm going to bring my co-host up, John Alstasis, but first I'm going to announce a couple of things. The O.J. trial came to a screeching halt the other day with guilty, guilty verdicts for everyone involved. And the issue is, where do you stand on that? And we'll be talking about that this week on the Micro Effect broadcast. I will also talk on that show about meeting Ron Goldman, the father of Ron Goldman. I met him when I was living in Arlington Heights, Illinois, and he had an apartment for rent, which I looked at prior to the O.J. murders, and some of the things I have for facts about that meeting and O.J. and the tie between Ron Goldman and Hertz rental car, which I thought was kind of interesting because I did a lot of research on it, and also the factor of how did his son really die. There's an interesting twist to this story in regards to the forensic that the media has not really talked about. It's in the forensic report, and that's going to be kind of a interesting scenario, and you can look into it and see what you think. We have on our show tonight our special guest, Dr. Judy Wood. Dr. Judy Wood is a renowned doctor, scientist, and she has been involved with the 9/11 investigation from the get-go. She has come out with very inclusive evidence that there was something else going on in 9/11, more than meet the eye, than just planes going into a building. There were things, phenomenons that were happening all around New York City at the time, and she's going to explain these things using her website and other information during this broadcast, which should be really fascinating. We're also expecting to have on Everett Halford, and Everett was also in New York during the time of the 9/11 nightmare, and he's going to share also what he saw on the streets. Both individuals have a lot of information. I think it's going to be a very worthy show. I'm going to bring my co-host up now, John Alstasis. John, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes. How are you doing, John?
Doing very good. Again, it's a cool evening in New York, in northern New York here, or central New York, I should say. And we had terrific chemtrails that were stirring the upper stratosphere to get us cold. We wouldn't normally be this cold, and or I should say we normally would be, but with the quantum, the fourfold of the electromagnetism and the Earth warming up due to the scholastics of the universe, it's not normal per se.
Well, maybe warming up. It's been pretty cold over here in the Midwest, and I had talked to Dr. Judy about the fact that there was 90,000 lightning strikes just before all this event happened with Georgia, a province of Russia, in the Chicagoland area. 90,000 cloud-to-ground lightning strikes. Got this information from one of the top meteorologists in the Chicagoland area, Tom Skilling. And I'm going to try to have him back on when he returns from Anchorage, Alaska. But I'm going to stop here and bring my special guest on, Dr. Judy Wood. The thing is, we need to kind of look at and revisit 9/11. Now, a lot of people say, well, why talk about it? It's over with. They say what? Okay, obviously, there was something very wrong with the picture that we were given to the downing of buildings in New York City. There was something totally wrong with the Pentagon and also the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. There were phenomenal amounts of speed with these planes, and one plane circled the World Trade Center in a way that no plane, no pilot has ever been able to do then, before or after. But, the thing is that we see things and we don't believe our eyes, and then we believe whatever is fed to us, and that's a huge problem. And I'm going to go to my special renowned guest, Dr. Judy Wood. Dr. Judy, are you there? I'm not sure. I thought she was online. I'm going to see if Evan Halford is on. Evan, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. How are you doing? How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm fine. It's good to be on your program.
Yeah, I'm very sorry to bring you in this quickly, but I was waiting for Dr. Judy Wood to come on, but you, too, are a person that people need to know a lot about, and you have a lot out there on the Internet, and I think you've been pretty well known. You've been on a number of broadcasts. You've been talking about 9/11. You have an interesting amount of documentation on eugenics, which I found really fascinating. And I wanted to ask you, if you wouldn't mind, going back to the day of 9/11, where were you?
Well, I work in the Trump building at 40 Wall Street, and I normally get in about 9:30 in the morning to 5:30 in the afternoon, and I was actually running late that morning, and I arrived at Penn Station because I live on the At that point in time, I lived out in, actually I lived out in Queens, but I took the Long Island Railroad in. And I remember because I got in the Penn Station, and I noticed people crowding around the television screens, and which is something very odd. You don't see people rushing. You know, they're not standing watching the TV monitors in Penn Station. And I could see that the buildings were burning. You know, the World Trade Center 1 and World Trade Center 2, the Twin Towers. And immediately it went through my head. I said, look, one plane running into a building is could be an accident. But I said, two planes, that has to be planned. And I got on the subway to go downtown, and immediately the thoughts that went through my head is, why am I doing this? This must be a terrorist attack of some kind. And I remember turning to someone on the train and kind of blurting out to them on the subway, the two train going downtown, this is a terrorist attack. And this person rode down with me to Chamber Street, which is right where the World Trade Center was. And I told him, don't get out there. You don't really want to go down there. I said, you know, these buildings have been attacked. And, you know, I remembered because, you know, back in 93, we were working on Washington Street. The company I worked for is a small insurance company. And we were just two blocks south of the World Trade Center. And I used to go into, you know, the mall there from time to time. There was a health food store there, and I would go and shop there. And so I got down there, and immediately, you know, this pandemonium. People were outside actually going and watching the people allegedly jumping off the buildings. And for some reason, I decided that I wasn't going to go out and be a gawker and watch all these. I didn't want to have these images because I knew about eugenics and I knew about mind control at this point. And I said, I began to think that this whole thing was a psyop, that they were trying to condition us to traumatize us. And I said, I wasn't going to go outside and engage in watching the people jumping off the buildings. And, you know, we were stuck in that building for till about 11 o'clock when they told us to evacuate. And I remember the eerie sense because, you know, we felt the earth shake allegedly from the first collapse. And then we felt the earth shake from the second collapse, and the cloud of dust that came in and nearly choked us all out. And as we walked out, you could see at least 6 inches of dust on the ground and papers flying everywhere, like a ticker tape parade. And, of course, where the buildings were, there was a huge plume of black smoke. And I knew from my chemistry background, because the first 2 years in college I was a biochemistry major, that black smoke was an oxygen, deprived fire. And I kept thinking, you know, there's something very odd about these events. Buildings just don't collapse like this. Fires don't burn like this. The strange smell that was in the air.
What was the smell like? What did you smell?
It didn't smell like a, you know, everybody's been to a barbecue. You've taken lighter fluid and you put it on a fire and you know what that smells like. And it didn't smell like that. It smelled... had almost a sweet, yet pungent, like the flower basil, you know, the plant basil, a kind of strange smell. And this is one of the things that, and even though they had given us these surgical masks, which I knew at the time, you know, were not going to protect us from the dust, but, you know, there was someone handing out, you know, surgical masks to put on people as they escorted us out. And we ended up getting lost from the crowd, and the three of us ended up walking up to right near where the Brooklyn Bridge was, and we spent the most of the day there. And I ended up walking back down to Broadway, and then I walked all the way up to 14th or 15th Street, and I finally caught a subway when they were running, and then I took the subway back into Queens. And the whole day had this eerie kind of Twilight Zone feeling, which reminded me very much of something odd and strange had gone on. And then, of course, I got home, and we put the TV on, and you watched them showing the plane hitting the tower over and over and over and over again. And I knew, I was reading, you know, Sherman Skolnick's report for months and months and months before this had happened. And he posted an article the very next day, about the foreknowledge. And there was another article called Hard Truth, Wake Up America, by a man named Robert Howard, which listed all the strange numerical anomalies, you know, how 11, and all the number 11s that were involved in the attack. And because I had some background in understanding Freemasonry and other things like that and knew all about these occultic numbers, I began to piece together that there was something other than, you know, what they were saying that was going on. And then I kept looking at them playing this plane going the building over and over and over again. And I said what I was seeing with my eyes didn't make any sense, because a plane, you know, runs into a building. It isn't going to go through it like it's a piece of butter. And still to this day, I've questioned people, did you actually see a plane strike these buildings? And I've gotten nobody that actually saw the first plane strike. And the second plane, I had a friend of mine that worked in Brooklyn right across the East River, and he said they actually saw a plane flying in the direction of the buildings. And he claims to have seen the plane go into the building, though I'm curious, you know, as to what kind of plane. And I quizzed him, and I tried to tell him, and you know, in those several days, and you know, we kept asking ourselves, how are they going to clean up all this dust? Knowing a little bit about chemistry, knowing about how you know the dust is going to be filled with formaldehyde and the mercury from all the computer terminals. How did they possibly plan to make us be able to go back to work? You know, the attack happened on a Tuesday, and the following Monday they were opening up Wall Street, and all the businesses were sending us down there. And I remember people laughing at this coworker of mine that was wearing a gas mask, you know, for the first few weeks. And then there was the constant smell of burning. Now, kerosene fires extinguish themselves as soon as, you know, the fuel is exhausted, which is in a few minutes. Even with, hundreds of thousands of gallons, allegedly, that were in these planes, yet these fires were burning for weeks.
I want to ask you a question right quick, Evan. You, at this time, I want to make sure I got you correct. Were you in the Trade Center building?
No.
Were you in at the time?
On 40 Wall Street, which is called the Trump Building. It's about a 65-story skyscraper built in the 30s. It's probably a block and a half away, within, about a two-minute walk or three-minute walk from where it's right on Wall Street. And in fact, every day now, sometimes I go over, not every day, but, you know, once or twice a week, there's a falafel stand, which stands where, within a stone's throw of the Trade Center, and I go over there and I walk and I see, you know, the big empty hole that's there. But even then, as you saw the debris falling down, and you saw the stack of the debris, one of the things that I heard Dr. Wood say on a radio interview was that there wasn't sufficient debris to account for the full mass of the buildings. And I can tell just from personal observation, that's another odd thing that took me, that didn't seem to make sense, was all of those towers were compacted in what looked like a two-story pile of rubble.
That's very...
Which is very odd. It just didn't make any sense to me. But, you know, since I was kind of conspiracy aware at this point in my life, and I knew about all the psyops, and I even knew that the first World Trade Center attack was basically a sting operation from, you know, the articles in the New York Times that I had read, it was a different, I had a different perspective than all of my coworkers and everyone else that was, you know, in a revenge mode and wanted to go out and attack every Muslim they could see. And I knew the only people that could carry this out were the kind of government psyop experts. And that even long before I heard Judy Wood talking about these exotic weapons, I had a sense.
Well, the one thing I wanted to ask you too here, you know, in what you saw. Now, this is my question to you. Your building was very, very close to these Trade Center buildings. I mean, every one of the Trade Center buildings all seemed to have gone down one way or another. Why was it that none of the other structures, experienced the same thing where they tumbled to the ground as well?
Well, we felt the shaking, which now I learned subsequent was the what occurred before the buildings collapsed. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw the seismic records and everything else, but now that I, but there wasn't a tremendous ground shaking, which one would suspect would happen if these buildings, in fact, fell, the way the official story says. And I was surprised. You know, one of the things we kept talking about, you know, before the, you know, I guess in the half an hour or so before the North Tower collapsed, after the first one had collapsed, was what would happen if the building fell sideways. It very easily would have toppled other buildings and destroyed other buildings. And we were stuck on the 14th floor of the Trump Tower, wondering how we were going to get out of there. Were we all going to live, or were we going to die? And this is a discussion going around the office. And when that cloud of smoke came in and basically you surrounded the building, they went into the ventilation system, and you could smell smoke throughout the entire building, and I had difficulty even breathing. And then when they told us we had to go out into this mess with the dust and the papers flying, you know, to this day I wonder, you know, what chemicals I was exposed to, what was I breathing into my lungs in those in that hour that we were walking.
Now, were there any of the papers disintegrated or burnt or spilled?
No, it looked like you know, computer papers, you know, just flying in the air. And I kept trying to think, if the buildings burned down, why would there be papers flying in the air like a ticker tape parade? You know, people throwing the papers. They were flying everywhere. And it must have been at least 6 inches of dust on the ground. It looked like a moonscape. And, you know,
so
I found out later.
It was powdered.
It was like a fine powder, like snow.
Woods on one of the lines, and I'm going to bring her up in a few minutes. But you said, see, this is the thing. It was really weird. I've had other people on the show, and I guess you've listened to my broadcast over the years. I've been on for quite a long time, because as you and others, this thing with 9/11 really bothered me to a level that I wanted to get to the actual truth and evidence of what it was that happened on that day. And the thing was, it was really amazing. I had people tell me things like, oh, it was half the heat of the sun. And I was saying, that's impossible and ridiculous for any human being to be in the area where there would be a situation where it would be an area where it would be that hot. So then I was hearing all these other strange phenomenon or stories that were going on, talking about it, speaking of, you know, 9/11, and, you know, it was just totally unbelievable. And then I started looking at Dr. Woods' pictures, and I saw things there that were things you would never see anywhere. If planes, I mean, just normal planes flying in the building with nothing attached, no alleged bomb, no nothing, would not leave the type of debris and things that we both are, you know, sharing here. It's entirely impossible. And then the powderization to this day has not been fully explained. So I want to ask you, Evan, can you stay here just for 1 minute? And we'll bring Dr. Judy Wood on now. And I would like you both to kind of interact on this. Dr. Wood, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
Now, I don't know if you heard what Evan was talking about there in New York, and it kind of confirms what you were saying, that you saw, you know, the powderization on the ground. And I was wondering if you can kind of guide us through the information and material you have and what you have concluded.
Well, there's a whole lot of things that just don't add up about the whole thing. And, yeah, what Evan was saying is very true. And what is interesting is that why is it only now that people are starting to hear about it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it this stuff I've been saying for a while, and, you know, the information has been getting silenced so strongly. This so-called truth movement, it's very much the truth control movement, but anyway, it's amongst the things that I've noticed is, well, first off, is the towers went away, they did not collapse, and we are told over and over again about you know, the words collapse, we're they tell us about a pile as though we're supposed to think that there's a pile there. You know, these various words that lead people to make conclusions that aren't necessarily true. So the towers went away, and they went away faster than anything could fall to the ground, even in a vacuum. The ground shook for only 8 seconds, and it would take 2 seconds in order to drop a bowling ball off the roof and have it hit the pavement below. So how could the buildings, you know, how could the ground shake for only 8 seconds, or less than 8 seconds for the North Tower, for the building to go away? Also, it didn't make enough of an impact for the building to have hit the ground. You know, that much, a 500,000-ton building did not slam to the ground.
It would have damaged other buildings around there.
Yeah, it doesn't just go straight down. If you did have that kind of impact, that's correct, if you had that kind of impact on the ground, what would happen?
Can I say something about the World
sure.
Financial Center? One of the things that seemed rather odd to me, the World Financial Center was no more than 30 or 40 feet away from the South Tower. And there were only two huge gashes out where several windows were broken. And, it just didn't make any sense to me. If something like that had collapsed, it would have damaged all the buildings around it. And, you know, the Building 7, of course, was a further distance away than the World Financial Center was. It seemed as if the only buildings that were damaged, was significantly damaged or disappeared, were the buildings that were, you know, part of the World Trade Center complex, and all the other buildings surrounding it, except I think for the Bankers Life building, the one, you know, that they're demolishing now. That building was, all the other buildings were somehow protected from this event.
Right. As I've said, all buildings that were destroyed had a WTC prefix and no other buildings. Actually, they had hoped they didn't damage Bankers Trust and actually repaired it and then started taking it apart, which seems like a pretty bizarre thing to do is to repair it only to take it apart. And I believe that the building was infected by whatever is disintegrating the material, and it's continued to disintegrate whatever's there. And that's
so it's kind of like a material, kind of like they had this thing a long time ago, Judy, it used to be able to eat away at oil spills. So is it something like that, something that was in that dust that would eat away at the structure? You think of the building?
I don't know if it was necessarily so much in the dust, but the dust is the result of it. It's like something that is deteriorating the building into dust is continuing to deteriorate the building in the material. If you think about the what I call them, those outer three columns wide by three stories tall, those sets of prefab structure, I call them wheat checks because they kind of look like wheat checks. And actually the first person to use that term was Bill Biggert. Where those are flying through the air, they don't ever hit the pavement. They dissolve before they hit the ground. And there have been folks who were having cameras on while this thing was happening, and it sounds just like a bunch of sleet coming down or snow. And if you have a kind of building, you know, raining down, it should be like raining dump trucks. And that was what I brought up to NIST in the recent comments submission, is that it would be equivalent to 10,000 to 20,000 Big Mac dump trucks that were raining down. And yet they said it was silent.
You
know, it would be whisper quiet.
The person that lived in the house with us was a steel worker, because we lived in a two-family house in the apartment right below us. And he went down there to volunteer, you know, to help deal with the steel, basically hauling the evidence away. And he kept made commentary to me that that they found some shoes with feet in them and things like that. But he said they never found anything of any particular size. He says that they didn't find computer terminals. They didn't find, pieces of desks. They didn't find anything that would indicate a collapse.
Yeah,
everything seemed to be
toilets.
Small. Yeah, papers were flying.
Yeah, but there's no toilets. Not a single
toilet.
And it should be ceramic toilets in, you know, a building, two buildings that are to house 50,000 people. You would have a whole lot of toilets left.
No, he said they didn't find anything. The largest thing they found were, he said, were parts of telephone keyboards.
Yeah, keypad of a telephone.
The keypad of a telephone. And they weren't even complete. He said there was nothing there.
It was just
there.
One. I believe it was just one that they found.
Yeah.
Piece of plastic.
Well, the thing is, too, they had mentioned that, I know that Rodriguez had said that there were some people that came in asking where the bathrooms were throughout the building. This was just before all of this happened, and they went in, he gave them the information, and they claimed it came from the Port Authority. That was interesting enough. And they were going through, for whatever reason, checking on the toilets. And then that week...
He said something like they were taking measurements, and I joke and say, what, to see if an airplane could park in there?
Exactly.
Yeah, why are they taking measurements of bathrooms? That makes no sense.
Well, the other thing that was really weird, too, was not only the people coming in, checking out the bathrooms, you know, and could have put some type of... detonation, additional device in it. But again, how much, and this is what I was wondering, how much airplane debris ended up on the ground?
I don't believe any.
Well, there were
None.
Some claims they had found part of an engine.
I'm talking about the shell of the plane itself. I have not, I mean, like wing sections, something big, feet, of that stuff. Was it on the ground in New York at all?
Not that I know of.
No, there were no parts of planes. Now, there was a picture that they have in the FEMA library taken at the end of October, but that showed a fuselage on top of Building 5.
Uh-huh.
But the picture is taken on top of Building 5 a month earlier, you know, in like the end of September, didn't show fuselage on top of Building 5. So it just showed up for that one day, and that one picture, it seems kind of strange.
Now, what about Building 1? Now, Building 1 was the big one. That was the first one that happened. And again, the plane in that one, what the media reported then, nobody ever saw any pictures where the plane actually went through the building. It was kind of like a jagged hole scenario. And it was, if that was the case, then the plane must have fell, I thought, to the ground. But there was no mention of debris of a plane on the ground then. Had you heard anything, Judy or Ev, on that?
No, actually there's testimony that when the first responders showed up that there was no airplane parts. Or, they saw no trace of airplanes on the ground. They saw bodies from people jumping out the windows, but they didn't see any airplane parts. But one thing I will say is you get any engineering professor, show them an airplane-shaped cookie cutter, cutout on the side of a building, like what we saw in Tower 1, and I believe their jaw will drop and they'll say, wait a minute, something's wrong
with
the story.
It's like cartoons, isn't it? Like these old Bugs Bunny cartoons or Roadrunner, where the coyote would be thrown into a cliff and then, he'd fall out and there would be the impression of his body cut into the rock.
The silhouette of passage. actually, there was somebody from a radio show who showed up first on the scene and described this airplane-shaped cutout, and they broke out laughing halfway through it, and then, quick got control of themselves. But, just like a small child knows how ridiculous that is, they laugh. That's why Roadrunner cartoons are funny, because they're impossible.
Well, the thing that's amazing, too, is the amount of cloud or smoke or dust or whatever the heck it was that blew through all of New York. I mean, it was like everything was just a cloud, a solid mass of particles.
and it just went through one area of New York, like, looked like foam, you know, or count, like one of those Count Tiki monster movies. But it just moved all through the streets of New York, putting this powder material through.
And you know how they cleaned it up? Just as an aside, I asked them, well, how did they in 5 or 6 days clean it up? They said they came out with hoses, and they washed it into the storm drains.
Yeah, I saw some pictures like from that afternoon where they had street cleaners out, you know, wetting it down and scooping it up, and then, you know, hosing down some more. Now, why was it so important on the afternoon of 9/11 to be scrubbing the streets and not, you know, and blocking the streets? The street sweepers are pretty big monsters. You know, that impedes any kind of traffic trying to do rescue operations.
They really don't hold much material either.
With the brushes that go swirling around. And I've got this one picture from FEMA that shows, you know, the little grooves in the street. It looked like they've been scrubbed out with a toothbrush because they're so clean. And that's kind of weird to see the grooves in the concrete completely void of any of the goopy dust stuff. That's what I got to asking about myself about, okay, they scrub the streets. Why? Because the streets are fuming. That's what I call it, the fumes rising up off the street. Well, what did they do with the lawn? Like the lawns in front of WFC buildings. You put street cleaners on the lawn. So what do they do with them? Well, let's go look at some pictures. Well, you can look at the pictures and, wow, brand new topsoil or potting soil dumped on the lawns.
Well, there's a listener in one of the chat rooms, and I just want to ask you this question real quick, Judy. He said that FEMA said that an engine of one of the planes that struck the Twin Towers miraculously survived the plane crash, and the towers exploded and collapsed. Is that true, that one of the
There's an engine at church in Murray, underneath a canopy. I don't know how it got there miraculously, because if it sailed over, the building 5 and the post office, in order to follow the trajectory, it would have to have gone through the building on the southwest corner of that intersection to land where it did. And it didn't make any divots in the pavement when it, you know, hit. And it just, you know, ends up sitting straight up underneath this canopy. But not only that, it's an engine from a 727 airplane, not a 767. So it's a long engine. Yeah.
I have a quick question.
Yeah?
As around my area, as I see the chemtrails, sometimes I can taste them. And sometimes I've actually taken pictures where they have like a half mile circle of where you can see they're heating up with the HAARP, some of the cloud structures, and it actually turns them, and you can actually see them do it for a half mile area, and then 2 miles down they'll do it again and heat up the atmosphere. And that there's at times where I'm going to tell you that my teeth start to ache, and I say they've got the HAARP operation going on, and that's making my teeth ache. Did anybody experience that kind of sensation that day? Around 9/11.
Yeah, I think that if somebody experienced much physical discomfort, they probably forgot about it after, you know, getting traumatized. But also, I don't ever, you know, name it as HAARP or whatever it is, because we don't even know what HAARP is. We just know what the rumor mill says it is. And, you know, there's something weird that happened that day. And we can look at the evidence and see there's evidence of electromagnetic fields. And we can also see sources of electromagnetic fields. And so how they got there, how it originated, how it was developed, we don't need to speculate on that too much. But, yeah, weird things happening. People throwing up blood, you know, weird stories like that. People feeling like they were levitated. And then we see cars upside down. It's hard to explain by, you know, building falling down, go boom. And, yeah, if by the seismographs, it doesn't make sense that the building slammed to the ground. So you think about what would have happened if it had. you would have flooded all of lower Manhattan and all of the subway tunnels and the PATH train tunnel over into New Jersey. It'd just be a tremendous amount of destruction.
Well, and then the pathway tunnel, this thing was above ground, but the building eventually collapsed somewhat under, ground from what we're hearing and seeing. So what happened in the tunnel itself? I haven't heard a whole lot about that.
Well, I don't think those tunnels were destroyed, really.
Not at all. They weren't. There's no leaks in them. The tunnels go under the Hudson. They come up to the bottom of the bathtub at the lowest level of the towers. And they actually, when it comes in, it goes right under Tower 2. And there's whole PATH trains that were lifted out of there in February of 2002 when they dug down that level.
When they had a subway strike and for I guess it was about 3 or 4 days, and we were required to take a long route, and I ended up taking the PATH train into the World Trade Center, what's left, what they call Ground Zero, and it traveled all the way around what they called the bathtub, and you could see that it really wasn't damaged. It's an amazing thing.
Simple bathtubs. It got a little bit of damage from the earth moving equipment during the cleanup process, but it wasn't the significant damage did not happen when two 500,000 ton buildings came crashing down on it, supposedly crashing down on it. So, but the earth moving equipment, that's when it got damaged. So what does that tell you?
And of course, they wouldn't let anybody go over there and look at it. At one point when we were down there, I walked out to my lunch, and they had everything blocked off, and they had these huge green kind of circus tarps, must have been 15, 20 foot high that were blocking off the view so you couldn't look down into the what was left of the so-called buildings, the debris, and see what was really going on.
Even up to last fall when I was there, took out my camera, and it looked like they were going to come confiscate my camera if we took pictures.
I heard
now,
people went down and tried to see what I'm doing.
I want to ask you both, on September 11th, there was a couple other weird things that happened. First of all, there was a mayor election going on for New York, and most of the fire department, police department were in a different area. There was a situation, too, that they had attempted to close down two fire departments in the area, and they had no working fighting equipment to fight fires on the Hudson River. They retired one, and they had to pull it out of the museum. But the worst thing that never was hardly reported until Dr. Judy Wood brought this back out in regards to Hurricane Erin. It was in the Atlantic Ocean. It was scurrying around out there. And Dr. Wood, can you tell what happened with Hurricane Erin that was right over there in an area in New York? Where did that go? And what happened to
it? Yeah, it's like for the 4 days right before it. It actually started a couple weeks earlier, but for the 4 days before 9/11, it couldn't have made a straighter line directly towards New York, going northwest, like passing Bermuda and just on a beeline, straight to there. And it pulls up to, it looks like a chalk line there. It just stops. And the morning of 9/11, like it was reporting for work. And that afternoon makes a U-turn and heads out of town. The outer bands of the hurricane were raining down on the end of Long Island and on Cape Cod. And it went south. It was about 500 or 600 miles in diameter. When it pulled up to those particular coordinates right off the end of Long Island, it spread out and got bigger, so it slowed down a little bit as it spread out further. And then when it packed up to head out, it tightened back up again. And it stayed hurricane status further up, I guess, until it got up to Newfoundland or somewhere around there.
Well,
it was studied by, it was unprecedented how much it had been studied. Beginning 2 weeks before it was born. I thought that was interesting. They began studying it in mid-August. And September 1st was when it became a named storm, or a tropical storm, I think.
Well, the thing is that, you know, you've been under a lot of attack due to the fact of, you know, coming up with this information and the pictures and things. And the thing was, it took so long for your pictures really to make it out there. You know, the things that you have are pictures that you could find nowhere. I mean, the powderization, cars that had rust on them. You want to explain how these cars were fuming?
I call them toasted cars. Toasted is a generic term, and I use a lot of generic terms so that we don't power pack our opinions in there and bias our observations. Then you don't get as much data by looking. So if you just give a particular phenomenon you notice, just give it an arbitrary name and stay with that name. Everything that looks like that same phenomena, you keep calling it that. So I call this toasted cars. Doesn't necessarily mean they're cooked. They're toast. They're history. You know, they're destroyed. They're mangled up or whatever. But one thing is seemed kind of interesting is the hood of the car is still down, but you look in and you see no engine. Or you can look through the wheel well and see it's empty in there. So whatever it was likes to eat engine blocks more than the body of the car. It also eats door latches and door handles. And it's just truly amazing. A regular car fire doesn't look like these pictures that I had seen. One of the biggest characteristics is that the windows are gone, 100% gone. You know, around the wheel and everything.
Vapored, or what type of way did the windows, what caused the
windows? I don't like to use the word vaporization because that has a specific meaning. And, you know, even people use the term loosely to say something vaporized. No, it's gone. It went away. We don't know what happened to it. Turned to powder. We don't, you know, dustified. The word dustification is a new word. It doesn't have any previous meaning. So I think it's a good word here because it turned to powder. We don't need to explain how it did.
And one of your sites, and this is what I agree with 100%, and I got kind of disturbed with people coming on my show talking about half the heat of the sun in New York being, and then there you saw people walking around in those areas, and I'm like, that's impossible.
Oh, yeah.
And then they have video 4 with Mayor Giuliani, who's running for president, and he actually believed, it says here, that it was 2,000 degrees where he was standing. Again, you know, that's...
where was he standing?
Exactly. And the thing is...
It's hotter than H, and where was he standing?
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, that type of heat, I mean, even, I think it's like 130 or 40 degrees is used to, you know, take a body and you, you know, turn it to dust.
Cremate
you know,
it.
Cremate the body. Not 2,000. I mean, 2,000 degrees. I don't know.
Well,
I mean,
one of my favorite ones is
amazing.
It's
amazing.
The steel-toed boots. You know, right. If the steel-toed boots are melting, it's kind of weird that there's absolutely no reports of burned feet in those melting boots.
What do you think was burning during those few weeks afterwards?
I don't believe it was burning like a regular fire. I believe it's a chemical reaction that was going on.
Much like you take magnesium and you put it in water or whatever and it starts breaking down and, I guess, oxidizing?
It turns into fumes.
Yeah.
It's not hot.
No.
And all the rumors that got set off with the, you know, about being hot, I believe that was a distraction from really noticing what was going on, including this luminescence. This particular effect that I've kind of concluded is very well related to this is known to luminesce at room temperature, cause metals to luminesce at room temperature. Without heat. So it looks like it's on fire. But if you put a thermometer in it, it wouldn't be hot. You know, a thermometer might, you know, disintegrate or something, but it's not associated with temperature. Like, if you pour some acid in your hand, man, would it feel hot. but that doesn't mean it's temperature hot.
Uh-huh.
And you had these people running down the street with this big wall of cloud chasing them down. After the cloud mowed them down and went on past, you just have people covered with dust. You don't see any cooked bodies.
No.
So
that's another thing, too. Why was it, and this is another huge question, the injuries and things, why was it that the government and volunteer organizations asked for so much blood, for everybody to donate blood to New York, when I didn't see anything that denoted any type of injuries that, you know, at that level? I understand there were some, but not to the level of blood that they were donating.
Because I think they were planning on killing more people than they actually, or more people died than they're willing to admit, either one.
I kind of think that the blood donation thing, if I didn't hear about it because I don't watch TV either, but my thoughts are that it's a very good part of the PSYOPs. That, you know, people ask questions until they're given answers. The answers
uh-huh.
don't have to make sense. The people just grab those answers and go with it.
Well, Julie,
they were passing out and telling people at businesses, give blood, and they were lying nonstop.
Well, Juliana was claiming there were 50,000 people that died in the building the first day.
Yeah, if you think about this is people being asked to donate blood, what does that do if you're asked to donate blood? You think that there's a big tragedy where people are all injured all over the place. That's what you visualize.
Uh-huh.
And that's maybe what they wanted people to visualize. I don't know for sure, but you know that could very well be it. Or it could be as innocent as somebody assuming there should be that many damaged bodies, so we're going to need blood before they canvass the site. But there's, there could be a lot of more people that disappeared than we know about. And I mean, they're gone. I don't think there's much left of people. I believe that the only bodies that were identified with DNA were the jumpers.
Were they really jumpers, though? I heard someone say that there was some suspicion that this was that some of these people were not alive when they were thrown off the buildings.
I believe that they were alive. This is a horrible thing to talk about, but I don't believe that those people like chose to jump to their death. No more than if you know, on your stove burner, imagine a stove burner red hot. You put your hand down on it, you don't stop to think about it. Your hand's just flying off of it.
Yeah, that's true.
So if you create such discomfort in those buildings, people are going to jump.
If you can't breathe, you've got to jump.
Right. You don't think about it. It's not a choice that you make. It's not like, okay, it's a good day to die or whatever. It's not committing suicide.
Yeah, what about those people that were they showed the video of them waving from the holes in the buildings?
I don't know if those pictures are real, but if they're real, it would make sense that, you know, you have people who are fine in there. I don't think that the discomfort issue was uniform at the same moment. I believe it moved through the floor, because I remember hearing some audio of some people talking on the phone, their cell phone, about the wave coming down, and they knew it was going to come get them. And shortly after that was the end of the phone call.
Well, hold up. The amazing man that surfed down on a piece of debris. We saw that on the news, and it, you know, it impacted on people. You know, people saw this one gentleman, he had a business suit on, his tie was in the back, and he was like on one piece of debris surfing down to his death. You know, and that was in one of the tapes a friend of mine had gotten on 9/11. You know, impossible things and stuff they were showing. I want to find out, Judy, is there a situation that can be explained to Building 7? You know, why did that go down, and what was your theory on Building 7?
Well, and what I submitted to NIST, I've started posting it on my website, parts of it, that that building did not slam to the ground. You know, with the approximate weight of that building, it would be like 10,000 full dump trucks or 20,000 empty, you know, Big Mac dump trucks raining down. Imagine 20,000 dump trucks parked in space over a football field, in, you know, square area, and then 47 stories tall, you know, distributed over that area. Imagine that many dump trucks crashing to the ground. You should hear something. You should feel something. And the seismographs show little more than background noise, if that. Some of them you couldn't even pick out a signal that was above background noise. And according to the NIST report, they have videos where they could pick up low-level conversations down the street while this was going on. They used that to quote, prove that there was no bombs in the building. But, you know, don't they stop to think, wait, if you have that much of a building slamming to the ground, it should be like raining dump trucks. Big thump noises. So it starts causing you to wonder if the building slammed to the ground or not.
Now,
and then you see all the powder.
Now, there's another huge question, too. The powdered material we're talking about, going into individuals' lungs. Now, again, we talked about how, you know, here there's possibilities of it eating away at engines and doing things similar to some type of...
I don't think the powder ate it away. I think there's something, an energy field that eats it away.
But if that energy field was inside or was, structured within that powder, how would that impact on somebody's lungs? That's my question.
If you have material that's breaking apart, if we look at the towers, and it looks like instead of the molecules being attracted to each other, they're suddenly repelling each other. And, you know, that's weird. And if somebody's breathing that, well, no human's designed to breathe that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it can't be helpful. Mm-hmm. And so I would expect weird cancers to have developed because of this weird stuff.
Well, the thing is, that's another thing, too. There have been organizations, White Lung, various things in New York City. They haven't gotten that much press whatsoever in regards to the conditions of people that have gotten sick. Now, there's a woman who's an anchor here in the Illinois area that's come down with some type of disease. She was on Ground Zero. And I'm hearing about these different situations with diseases from lungs. Have you heard anything about any lawsuits or anyone doing anything to interject some type of, scenario?
I think there are some, legal action involved there, but it's hard to, make anything of it.
I think all the lawsuits are being
handled
by one judge.
Information that's available. What?
I said I heard that all the lawsuits are being basically sent through one judge, so it's very difficult to get discovery. He's not granted discovery in any of the cases that have come before him. So you can't get subpoenas issued. You can't, and a lot of them he's dismissed on, on summary judgment. Just says there isn't sufficient evidence, or the sovereign immunity.
Well, see, that's the whole crux that I've been talking about that a lot of my broadcast, the use of these summary judgments, because, see, it's kind of like a thing, that, a little trick that they use. You write up a summary judgment so the judge doesn't hear the other side of the equation, because you already have been under a contractual law found either guilty, or your evidence doesn't support. The only thing that supports the case is the summary judgment that's filed from whatever side gets it in the court first. So, that's a victimization method that they're doing, including of gagging people's cases. Now, Judy, I don't know if you're willing or able to discuss your case. Can you discuss any part of it, or is it still not possible for you to talk about?
No, I can tell you what it's about, but I don't want to discuss the details of it. Uh-huh. What it's about is that the contractors who were hired with taxpayer money to help NIST with their report defraud the American people. You know, like a company that's, for example, UL, who does testing for fires, they had done a mock-up of the floor system and for a couple hours had it burning as high as they could get it burning, and they couldn't get it to fail to support load, so they called the test. And they tried another one. Yeah, doesn't work. Well, after all, we had huge tests in 1975 on Tower 1 over several floors before they had sprinklers in the buildings. Didn't cause a problem. So how can somebody who knows that that couldn't have done it sign off a report that says that that did it? That's where I have a problem.
And this is a valid one.
And I say, you know, energy weapons were used. I use a very broad term. Again, you know, direct energy weapons is energy. It was directed, and it was used as a weapon. Of course, I don't know the serial numbers. I'm not privy to that. But we have companies hired as part of the defense industry who develop and manufacture directed energy weapons who were hired by NIST to help on their report. And I think that's a conflict of interest. And, you know, they certainly would recognize the evidence of direct energy weapons having been used, or, you know, energy weapons in general. When you get material that keeps disintegrating, if you had a bomb in the building, bombs break big chunks of concrete into smaller chunks, but you still have chunks of concrete. They go flying. And as soon as a bomb goes off and breaks something down, the pieces go flying. They don't keep getting smaller as they fly. Uh-huh. And what we saw in 9/11 was, as the pieces fell, they were dissolving, like Alka-Seltzer tablet.
What you say, now, this is kind of a strange question. Maybe it's not for you, but... I was under the theory, you know, when you talk about this type of situation with energy weapons and the type of person that would have to put this together, it would be far more advanced than the individuals that we're talking about that were flying these alleged planes in the buildings. I would say the person would be almost on the level of being a physicist, if not the more. Would have put together the scenario to see and make it work. What is your opinion of that? Whoever did this had to be in that realm as being a physicist.
Well, I don't like to speculate on who done it. I think it's important is we go in the right order of an investigation. Number one, what happened? Define what happened before you do anything else. Then, once you look at the data will speak to you and tell you how it was done, what mechanism was involved. And then after you figure that out, then you can move on to who done it and why they did it and whatever else. But first you have to look at what happened. If you assume what happened then go to who done it, you might be totally wrong and never realize it. And I'm still at the, you know, what happened. I think I've pretty well defined it. You know, one of the other pieces of evidence that we haven't talked about here is the magnetometer data that was recorded in Alaska. There's abrupt shifts in the Earth's magnetic field at the precise moment that the plane holes appeared in the buildings, plane-shaped holes. I won't say airplanes hit the buildings. No, these holes appeared in the building, and right at that moment, there's an abrupt shift in the Earth's magnetic field. I think that's pretty weird. And there's a buildup for, 20 minutes before the North Tower gets its hole. You get a signal building up, building up, building up, and as soon as the hole appears, it reverses the direction. It's unbuilding up. And then as soon as the South Tower gets its hole, the curve levels off. It's, you know, abrupt shifts in the chart. And then by the time the second tower went poof, The chart was going wild all over the place. And then Building 7 goes poof, and the chart levels out. Almost like it was meant to undo what was being done. It was meant to reverse a process. But but it didn't quite reverse at all, which is why the process is continuing.
Well, that's the reason why I was saying it would be someone that would have been able to, you know, physically design this. It is not somebody that is just a common individual there that wouldn't have a background in physicists to do this type of thing, Judy.
You're doubting that some guys in a cave in Afghanistan could plan this?
No, there's no way, and that's what I'm saying. You know, it's no way on Earth that you know, Bin Laden, who was the CIA operative or whatever, with kidney problems with a stick in the 120 degrees heat, came up with you know, a couple people just in a couple planes doing it. It's totally impossible. And then I want to ask you what you felt about Stephen Jones' thermite theory. Did you feel that made any sense in this from the physical evidence that you saw?
Well, thermite's a welding material.
Yes.
If you go to my homepage, that's drjudywood.com, at the top of the page is a link to the FAQ page, Frequently Asked Questions. And down further down the page, I have a video showing some kids getting some thermite going on top of a block of ice. Guess what happens when the pot melts?
What?
It explodes. The ice explodes. They have thermite on ice, and you get steam explosions. If something is very hot, you know, water, when it becomes steam, expands by 1,600 times in volume. That's how a pressure cooker, why it has to let off steam, why it has so much pressure in it. So you'd have huge steam explosions. So imagine all those toilets in the building. If you had any kind of heat, those toilets would be exploding. And it'd spill over on other buildings, I'm sure, with all the explosions. But thermite melts things. It doesn't explode except by heating up water. And, you know, a tremendous amount of anything. I mean, you don't have a building melting into a puddle either. Thermite does not turn things into powder. We had things that, as it was flying through the air, it turned into powder. You know, you have some chunks flying, and the chunks get smaller and smaller, like they're dissolving. Like, you know, it looks like ice cream on a hot day, and the ice cream never hits the pavement. You know, it's just, you know, the steel turns into powder before it hits the pavement.
And
so,
the temperature in New York at that time, I think it was in the 70s or 80s, if I remember correctly. And it was like, I checked into it, it was like 79 or 80 degrees throughout New York.
Yeah, I think
York.
82 or 83 was the high point of the day.
Yeah, so I didn't see anything that showed during that time or after that the temperature ever rose any higher than that. I mean, but all over the news, press, everything was, you know, 2,000 degrees, you know, things about half the heat of the sun. They were sending fire marshals in, and they had their full gear on. A lot of people didn't even seem to feel the heat. There was one picture you have that really bothered me. It was
these
two women, and one of them had a fur-like coat, and the other one had a leather coat, standing in these dust fur ball things that were whizzing up off the ground. And it was kind of like, you know, that is that hot? How could you wear a leather coat or a fur coat?
Well, not only that, the water main on West Street broke that day. That afternoon, and it turned into a lake. And you see these guys wading out, like, you know, ankle deep into the lake. And with that kind of water, you know, it didn't even turn into steam. So how can it be hot? You know, the whole street was just flooded out. It was up to, like, the hubcaps of the cars sitting around.
So do you think that there was molten steel or iron in the basements of the of those buildings?
Not that I've ever been able to see, and it's inconsistent with every bit of evidence I've seen. Like, I've got a picture of some guys going climb down a ladder into the basement of Tower 2, and there's a puddle down there with somebody's wet shirt laying in the puddle.
Even the men that were supposedly... you know, they were found alive in that building, and they were saying it was molten feel right near them, they, you know, to be honest with you, how would they really have survived? You know, being
how long did it take to cook a turkey?
they were not able to walk out, but they were able to bring them out, and they weren't, you know, there was nothing showing.
They did walk out. A lot of them did walk out. They said that it was like walking out onto an empty football field. This is after 4 hours. In other words, there's no material there. Where'd the material go? There's other testimony. It's kind of interesting that remember Tower 2 went poof first. There's some firefighters that went into, or some first responders that went in to Tower 1 from Tower 2. They went from 2 into 1. And then they heard something outside, and they came out on the south side, and they didn't see Tower 2 there. So they thought they got disoriented and came out the north side of the building. Because, you know, where's the tower? It's supposed to be a tower here. I think that's pretty weird. The, you know, the tower's just missing. Other things that went missing, like the main whole of Building 4, except for the north wing, which was, like, surgically cut off, polished down to the ground, nothing. You know, what happened to it? It just went missing. And that tipping top of Tower 2, you know, how it tipped over, and if it fell to the ground, it would have fallen on top of Building 4. But it just turned to dust to powder.
What is this thing that happened to the Bankers Trust building? I don't know how you would describe that. It was kind of like parts of the building kind of hanging out, you know, from the outer shell. There was glass broken, but it, how did that happen with the Bankers Trust building on Liberty Street?
Well, it was just this big gash in the front, big void. It went, I don't know, 20 feet in, 20 to 30 feet wide. It was a big
gash. Yeah, well, what caused that if nothing hit it?
Well, if something hit it, it would hit it. It wouldn't remove the material and disappear. So this material is missing, and it was stated by FEMA that there were no fires in this building. There are no fires in the building. Why do we have this piece of steel? Of course, fire wouldn't explain either. So this piece of I-beam that looks like kind of crinkled up on the end. You know, if you get a piece of plastic and put it over a fire, you know, the plastic kind of coils up, or if you get a ribbon, like a package ribbon, and you scrape one side of it, how it curls up.
Yeah.
This steel beam looked like that. The material had been affected in such a way that it just kind of crinkled up. It shriveled up at one end. And there were no fires in that building. So what happened to steel beam? And steel just weakens material or melts it if it's hot enough. You can't,
well, and
you
also, Judy, I want to ask you, too, in this nightmare of New York City, if this was not planes and it was something that came from outside the realm of, you know, this atmosphere and from outer space, from possibly a satellite or something that they used as a cross beam with something else underground or some whatever kind of way they did it. Why was it that nothing else was destroyed, like any other aircraft in the area? Because, again, during that time, there were at least 3 or 4 levels of helicopters in that area. There were 2 or 3 of them that were news-based helicopters that were, you know, I guess reporting the traffic going on at the time. And there was another report of another helicopter somewhere else. Why was it none of these planes were affected if there was some type of, situation that was, disturbing the field, you know? Can you understand that kind of where I'm talking?
One thing is that's very interesting is that supposedly all planes were grounded. Remember hearing about that. All planes are grounded that morning, including military aircraft, except for, quote, some top-secret missions. A few top-secret missions. Everything else was grounded until 2 minutes after the North Tower went poof. That was pretty weird. that 120 seconds, you know, just 2 minutes after the North Tower goes poof, suddenly military aircraft can take off again. But what were these dozen or so helicopters flying around? Were they news helicopters? Why were they allowed in the air? And military aircraft were not even allowed in the air.
Well, there was a report by a gentleman by the name of Steve Forbes, and he is was working for one of the companies in the World Trade Tower, I think it was Building 2, and he talked about how they were told to remove or be, and they informed him through the Port Authority that all of the power would be down, security would be down in the building over the weekend. So he was saying that the major fiduciary companies were moving their records out of the World Trade Center to other bases, and he was one of the programmers involved in it. And the thing that he said that was very interesting to me is the fact that, you know, while this was going on, you know, they had no security whatsoever in any of the buildings. It was all down. Why was the order of power?
To me, that's, I believe, hearsay of, you know, about no security in the building.
No, that wasn't hearsay. There was a document that came directly from the Port Authority, and they shut down the power, and they moved all of their fiduciary records.
Now, I can see why they might have the power shut down momentarily while they're switching over to some other power system or changing something with the power grid, but...
this is what he said. They were fixing something in the building over the weekend. This is before anything happened to the towers. So they opened the gateway for anyone to come in and do anything if the security cameras and systems were down. You know, why would you put the building in?
I like to base things on physical evidence that I can sample myself, rather than, you know, trusting somebody's memory of what they thought they remembered or what they thought somebody told them.
Well, it wasn't that. I mean, again, he was a programmer, and his whole thing was removing records. It was a number of firms moving records from the World Trade Center overseas for some of these big fiduciary companies because they were concerned that there was no security and there was a problem with possible power outages so that they would not be able to do transfers and transactions. And then the risk of power outages.
That's not unusual. And in all buildings, they also do certain maintenance on different things and do, you know, shut down power for different things. So that's nothing huge.
Well, I never heard of them all weekend. I've worked in a lot of these big, huge firms, and not like a whole building with no security cameras or nothing for a whole weekend.
Well, where I have worked, they have, you know, warned us of a power outage because they're going to upgrade something, and so we know to shut off our equipment the day before.
Not a whole weekend.
Yeah, that's happened.
I worked in Sears Tower. I worked in Standard Oil Building for some of the big corporations there, and they have not done anything like that because, you know, again, that opens the door for security breaches. You know, if you have a situation where you have banks and fiduciary companies in there, then while that's down, it's opening the possibility.
Right, but still, that doesn't explain why the building turned to powder.
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't, but it is a part of the scenario.
Why we don't see anything the building's left. You could say that there's foreknowledge in that, but for me it doesn't prove a whole lot because the buildings I've worked in before have had power downs over weekend when they're upgrading they're switching to some new switching unit for connecting to the power grid or something like that. And that's not, you know...
I guess from my point of view, there's levels of forensics on this. You know, you're looking at the building, the powder and all that evidence. That's one level of forensics that needs to be, you know, made in order to make, you know, the equation of what it was or what caused the whole buildings and everything.
Well, I guess the reason why I don't like to rely a whole lot on hearsay
But if there's documented evidence on this,
I don't have that documentation in front of me. I don't have a sworn affidavit. I can't question the person under oath. So to me, it's hearsay.
But not if you have but I'm saying if you have people, and I understand under oath, but like if there's a document coming from the Port of Authority itself, and the people had hands on it,
okay, but
and had
but
evidence,
I have not seen anything.
I'm just mentioning it here. It's just like I've
heard lots of people talk about how they know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who thought they saw some molten metal. That doesn't prove there's molten metal there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see other evidence against it, you know, and but still, to me, it doesn't really prove much of anything about a paragraph.
But it adds in to figuring out, you know, again, you have to have the information you have in order to figure out who did it.
Right. If you wanted to get to that point, first you have to figure out what happened before you go looking at who did it. But in order to use this as evidence, I believe you'd have to have that person sworn in under oath with documentation that shows exactly who ordered this power down.
It came out of the Port of Authority. And it's just like, the thing is that the Port of Authority with New York, and this is documented.
I've not seen any documentation on that. So if I haven't seen documentation on it, I can't use it as evidence.
Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that if there is a documentation...
If there is, somebody could produce it, and then it would be evidence. But until then, it doesn't exist.
I understand.
Okay.
Totally, because I worked in the court system, and I know
see, this is a psychological operation, and what happens in a psychological operation is that people rely on stories that they hear by word of mouth.
I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at court dockets. I don't look at none of that. I don't read. You know what?
Right.
People tell me every day to read people's blogs and things, and if I do, I might cruise through it. But I look at the actual physical evidence.
Well, maybe you can send me documentation on it.
I'll have Stephen Forbes contact you because it bothered him and it bothered me because, again, I know that the 69 East Washington building across from the Daily Plaza had the same kind of thing. It had FBI, all the hubs for major government security agencies in that building. And during the time that I was working with these big companies that had all these floors, they had locked off most of the stairwells where people could not exit on certain floors. And because of that, that caused a lot of people to die.
Can we talk about some physical evidence?
Yes, okay.
Okay, yeah, I prefer to talk about physical evidence.
Okay, all right.
Things that can be demonstrated and proved.
Well, this is demonstrated and proved. And like I said before, if you look at this, it's obvious. And from what you're talking about, it has to have the fingerprints. And it has to be also determined, Judy, who or what type of person or mind would have been able to put this stuff together. And you know, and I know, it's totally
Before you can charge somebody with a crime, you have to know what crime was committed. Like, if you have, let's say you have a dead body, so you haul somebody into court and charge them with stabbing somebody to death. Well, it turns out that the body has bullet holes in it, no stab wounds.
Okay,
so therefore, the person you just charged gets off for life.
Yeah, but a good example is this, and people don't talk about this, but O.J. Simpson went to trial for the death of his wife. And from what I saw in the forensic evidence of the autopsy report, Ron Goldman was never standing. He died in a pool of blood in one spot as though he was lifted and placed in that spot and stabbed in his chest area. And the blood fell in a certain area. I'm just giving you an example of forensic. So on that forensic level, you can look at who and where could be doing that. So you're giving us forensic of physical, and I'm saying on the other end, the forensic evidence is that there was a problem with the Port of Authority from day one. there was information that there was insurers that were involved.
And that proves what?
It proves that the fact that there are were persons that had the money and power and control to do what we're talking about were people that had the ability to think and make equations to create the phenomenon that you're talking about. No,
what phenomenon am I talking about?
The situation of buildings being turned to powder. These things.
Have they done this before? Can you demonstrate? See, I don't get into the whodunit because this has never been done before.
Who do you think did this? And by the way, I've been listening.
I don't know, and I don't go there.
Uh-huh.
I think
the capability of doing it.
Right.
Certainly.
You have to know the capability of what it is that could have performed it. Indeed, the information you're putting out there is 100% solid and good and inclusive. But the thing is that when you get this evidence, you know, you can mastermind it down to the finest detail of what the evidence supports of doing. My role is looking at and taking your evidence and inclusively adding it into court dockets, records, testimony from individuals that were there, police officers that were physically there, and individuals that saw certain things that were not undisputable.
Yeah, I'm uncomfortable with this conversation because I like to look at first what happened. That's the most important thing. And only after you concretely establish what happened are you even eligible to figure out how it happened.
I understand that, Judy, but I'm just going to say to you, you have enough evidence here. I understand what you're saying, totally. But you have enough evidence that supports it. It can't come from column A or B. There's no way that two planes went into those buildings and caused this, number one. There was no Muhammad Atta and a few guys that just did this. That's number two.
Correct. Now, that doesn't prove who did it.
No, I'm not saying it proves, but it shows a scenario of the type of person that would have been able to do what you're talking about doing. Normal individuals out here that are from desert regions or individuals that don't have a very high level of education could not sit there and take a physical thought process and make it into reality of taking out buildings and making other buildings still stand and then create a powderization with no heat signature. That is defiant to the logic of any, you know, like myself. I'm sitting here, I'm like, okay, let me go in the kitchen and make this into powder. I can't do that. So what I'm saying to you is I'm taking the physical equation that you're giving and looking at it logically from outside.
If you don't understand what happened and how it was done, how on earth can you expect to figure out who did it?
Okay, again.
Well, can I interject, please?
Sure.
Uh-huh. You know, as the Romans would say, follow the money in their judicial system, and we had such a things like they used up the workman's comp fund. All these people that supposedly died would have had, number one, pretty good insurance. Their families probably had three-figure numbers coming at them. But the workman's comp fund was used to subdue their tragedy. And, again, here we have the workman's comp. So they spent, I don't know, a couple $1 million, and it drained the workman's comp to zero. But then we follow the numbers back on workman's comp and find out that they're generating $40 billion a year in New York State for workman's comp. And it's like, okay, the government has developed a cover-up of workman's comp being delinquent and using it for this situation. So it's kind of like following the money.
Right. I mean, if you have a logical situation of this magnitude, you know it's going to cost a very large sum of money to have this done, number one. And you have to look at the type of person and the type of mind that would be able to develop something like that. And like I said, I'm looking at physicists. There's no way that a normal person could do this.
Can I interject one more thing? Because it's kind of contradictory to what I just said. In the same interim of history repeating itself, of us generating from war to war and us having to repeat, you know, it's like...
I'm uncomfortable with this conversation, and I'd like to end it.
Okay.
Because I don't want to get into who did it and implicating,
I'm saying that. It has nothing to do with
Okay, well, she just wants to drop it, Deanne.
Sure.
Because I don't want to get charged with finger-pointing that I didn't do.
Well, you never said that. It came from me. And folks listening, it came directly from Deanne Burley, not Judy. I am looking at this from outside and as an outsider, and then looking at it logically. That's what I would surmise.
The only thing I'm
involved in, it has nothing to do with you. Nothing.
Is the physical evidence of what happened and who's covering up what happened. That's that's what I'm involved in.
I understand that, and I just was interjecting what I was looking at from what you had said and other people that have evidence as well to support different areas of theory, not what you're doing. But you can continue. I'm sorry, Judy.
What bit of evidence should we talk about?
Well, let's go back to the Hutchinson effect. Can you talk about that?
What question did you have?
The question I have was on the hurricane of Andrew or Aaron. Has anybody looked at that as not only the physical being of it, but also looking at it into the aspect of being a military act? And it's like, all right, you might have like one military act creating it, but then another military act counter creating it on that scale of scalar activity.
One thing I will say about Hurricane Aaron is that the morning news that told us about the weather for the day has showed this weather map of the continental U.S. out into the Atlantic Ocean. They showed that patch of the ocean, but they didn't put this little pinwheel icon that shows a hurricane there. You know, what's with that?
Sure.
And if you do have a hurricane aiming straight to New York City, that you don't know if it's going to hit the city or if it's going to stall out or what's going to happen. If it stalls out and turns around, you're going to get storm surges. And Manhattan's, what, 20 feet above sea level?
Right.
And then there's the airport. You got to worry about evacuating people. Why weren't people told about this? And that is something that I will look at because that's very physical-based.
Can you give me a reference to Hurricane Aaron where we could find out information about it?
On my website, drjudywood.com/articles/Aaron, E-R-I-N. Or from my homepage, you'll see a bunch of pictures. You'll see some pictures of hurricanes. Just click on those and you'll get there. But it's drjudywood.com/articles/Aaron, E-R-I-N.
And do you know the point of origin of that hurricane?
It started out in the Atlantic somewhere, and then it came across and went up. I've got the path on various pages in there. There's even some graphics that show it. Even some animated GIF files that show, trace its path. that it went past Bermuda, I guess in the 9th and 10th. And what was interesting is before it passed Bermuda, it had become a Category 3, and they downgraded it to a tropical storm before it passed. And I thought that was kind of odd, and so they didn't want to leave an impression there. Another odd thing was that the International Space Station was flying right overhead about the time that Tower 1 went poof, the second tower that disappeared or went away. And they had to have zoomed in the camera and held the camera real steady to keep the hurricane out of the field of view.
Have you heard about this Russian cosmonaut that apparently is now saying that he saw the attacks from the International Space Station?
I didn't know what he was going to say. I heard he was going to say something, and I was wondering if he was going to talk about the hurricane. Because imagine what that looked like from space. I've got pictures of what it looked like from space. You know, it was a huge, huge thing. They have to have noticed it.
I can't imagine seeing a plane from space. It would be like seeing a speck of dust.
Well, he claimed that, I heard that he claimed that he was on this Russia Today, or one of the English language channels in Russia, that they had a presentation. Apparently they showed that film Zero, I think it was, and then they had a discussion afterwards. You know, this, of course, hasn't been played or even referenced in the controlled media over here, but apparently he mentioned that he had some of the sophisticated optics equipment that he was using to, you know, to watch what was going on the ground.
Well, if it's in conjunction with the movie Zero, I tend to wonder about it because that movie doesn't talk about, you know, the information that's out there. It doesn't talk about the hurricane, doesn't talk about dustification. I think it has thermite, you know, melting towers or something like that. Yeah, again, that's just what somebody thought they saw, but I have their video they took from the space station as they're going overhead. There's a bit of the audio that was blocked out, but there's a part of the audio that is just really kind of hilarious. They say, well, we're looking up down the East Coast to see if we see anything else. Like a hurricane? You know, they see a hurricane? And to not mention the hurricane, you know, the edge of the outer bands were over the end of Long Island, also over Cape Cod and further down east. So it's weird that it wouldn't be mentioned, and that drives me to question things.
What is the difference between the HARP mechanism and let's see, where this gentleman wrote a question about HARP. Is there a difference in HARP and direct energy weapons?
My definition of what I say was caused by, you know, what happened to towers was energy that was directed and was used as a weapon. That's what I call directed energy weapons. Oh, let me use this opportunity to spell out clearly. I never use the term space beams or ray beams from space or laser beams or lasers, masers, and plasmoids or however the story goes. Those are terms that others use to distract away from the evidence. What I say was energy that was directed and was used as a weapon. Very broad category, but it eliminates the idea that kinetic energy was used, in other words, bombs, things that go, you know, ignite, go flying, have pieces of stuff go flying, or shooting bullets, or, you know, things like that. But energy and energy fields intersecting and field effects. Like, the most simple example I think that we all know is lightning. There's sort of a potential between the cloud and the ground, and you see an arc that goes between the two. Now, imagine, you know, can you force that arc to hit in a particular place? Well, that's what lightning rods are for. But you could maybe put a signal someplace here or there and get a lightning bolt to connect to that spot. I'm not saying that lightning was involved here, but it's a type of energy. And if you could direct another kind of energy that you don't see, it's out of the visible light range, within another field or several fields, that's what I'm getting at.
Do you think these were ground-based or satellite-based directed energy weapons?
Again, I'm not saying it was like a ray beam from anywhere. Field effects with something else involved in it, and I don't think it matters so much where it was coming from. You know, it could have come from a satellite, could have come from ground, could have come from a building. You know. But there are fields that were generated anyway, like from the hurricane. There was evidence of field effects from that hurricane because there was thunder recorded at each of the area airports.
One of the interesting things I heard in another interview, you were talking about how you believe that these tornadoes and hurricanes are more an electromagnetic effect than they are actually a meteorological effect, that these are results of electromagnetic changes in the atmosphere. And
right,
I was wondering,
again, on my FAQ page, I've got a picture of this tornado that starts from the ground up. And you can't say that's like a Coriolis effect or some swirling. like a drain or something like that. It's there's a, except in the sense that you have some electrical field or magnetic field.
And you claim that these odd things that happen in tornadoes, like, you know, straws being jammed through you know, trunks of trees, and was a result of actual physical changes in the matter of these
objects. Exactly. Yes. Yes.
And rather than, you know, the result of what we would call the standard physical forces of wind speed and, you know, our cars being lifted up and tossed and, you know, on tops of trees with no apparent damage done to them, that these are electromagnetic effects, much like what you mentioned earlier, the Hutchinson effect.
Yes, one of John Hutchinson's samples, he's got a piece of wood inside of aluminum block. And you can't melt aluminum, pour it over wood, and have the wood not disintegrate.
So we're talking about an exotic effect that's produced by a kind of energy weapon that ultimately just changes the material structure.
Yes.
And, we would say demolecularized, you know, the material in the, you know, that it's directed against.
Well, if you go back to the Philadelphia Project, and it's not only disappearing, it's time travel. They had bodies that formed supposedly back into the hulls, and they were just trying to make it disappear initially. But again, as the UFO mechanism, you know, 6960975 says that actually, as they were able to develop the UFO mechanism on transverse of electromagnetics and coil systems, they also transverse time.
So in addition to being a psyop, which I think the entire 9/11 experience was designed to have certain psychological effects upon people. It could also have been a laboratory itself to test exotic weapons or exotic devices of one kind or another.
Yeah, on a larger scale. I do believe that. And one thing to remember about the first atomic bomb experiment is they didn't know if the reaction would stop. They didn't know if it was self-quenching. In other words, the government knew that the scientists didn't know if whether or not the process would stop. And I believe, you know, you can extrapolate from there and say, well, you know, the same thinking might have been involved here. You know, that's why I was also concerned about the thing in CERN, is that they're going to try this experiment without knowing, you know, if it'll stop or if it'll split the Earth in half. Or you probably remember hearing a lot of chatter about the thing in CERN.
They're going to do the same thing on the 21st with that proton shooter in Sweden for making a black hole.
Yeah, destroy split or not. Yeah.
There was an old Star Trek Next Generation where the crew was deteriorating and literally dissolving. I don't know if you remember that or even watched the program years ago. And they had some kind of a directed energy weapon that was being used against them by some alien race that was literally disintegrating the ship.
Oh, that sounds just like this at Gizmo.
And, there was a joke that writer John Coleman made that oftentimes the movies and television will tell you more of the truth about what's going on than you'll ever hear on the news, that there was more truth told in so-called fiction than you'll ever hear in the so-called factual-based news programs, allegedly factual, I should say. So, this is a kind of telescoping, you know, some of the technologies that exist, because I know, you know, that what is the mainstream is about 30, sometimes people say even 50 to 100 years behind what is actually going on in the laboratories, in these, you know, secret government laboratories. So I'm just curious.
Yeah, I fully agree. And so I'm projecting onto, you know, what happened on 9/11, that whoever did this, you know, they didn't necessarily know if it was going to be self-quenching or not. And it appears that it was not self-quenching. You can look at it from the magnetometer data that all the curves quit, you know, jumping all over the place when Building 7 goes poof, but they're still in an oscillation mode. They're still resonating with something. Something's going on.
Well, when we first started the program, we mentioned numerology a little bit, and I just wanted to bring up the idea on 9/29/08. If you take 29 is a 2 and a 9 would add together as an 11. And we had the financial crush. Supposedly they were going to vote on the policy of the $700 billion bailout, and they said they didn't do it. But then the BloombergReport.com said that the Federal Reserve that day gave $630 billion for bailout, and yet they still, it was like insider trader information of like, who's the woman that got set up for insider trading there, Martha Stewart. All of a sudden we had people doing insider trading, and then two-thirds of a week later they said, oh, we're giving $700 billion, and now we hear that they're giving $800 billion to China for bailout and for Merrows. And then, let's see, what else happened here that's kind of, it's just this ongoing misinformation and false information or lies that the government's giving us. Another item I've heard was that October 4th is actually Christ's birth date, and it was 4 BC, which makes today 2012 from Christ's birth. And
I've heard this,
yeah. So is October 4th.
I don't know anything about that. I don't know anything about that. I don't.
Yeah. Well, this is a question too of the date of Christ's birth, because you know, some people said that it's 2004, but Herod didn't take reigns until 2004, and they're saying that his birth date was actually 2007. I was looking into that, so you know that's not really, you know, a fact. It's a possibility. Because we still don't know exact dates and times because of the calendars then. So it's very hard to conclude what the actual date of Christ was, or, you know, the, you know, information of existence of the time of Christ. So that's a very hard number to, you know, come up with.
I'm pointing out is on the numerology possibility is the 21st is the December 21st, I think 2012 is supposed to be the end times per se. Well, all of a sudden on the 21st of this month or the 23rd of this month, we're going to be doing that test for the atom smasher in the black hole. And, gee, it just happens to fit the criteria to some extent of what's happening in front of us.
Yeah, who knows?
Interesting
anyhow.
But the thing is, Judy, we're coming to the last part of the show, and I thank you very much for coming on. And you had some really great information. I want you to give our listeners the site to go to look at the material that you have. Can you give that information here?
Sure. I'm also curious who all I've been talking with here. But, my site is drjudywood.com. That's drjudywood.com.
Uh-huh.
Drjudywood.com. Yeah, who are the other people who are here?
Okay, and everybody that's up here, John Alstas is my co-host. He was the one that was just there. And the other gentleman was Ev. Ev was in New York. Ev Hallford, and he was in New York during the time of September 11th, and he's written a number of articles in regards to that, and also the situation with eugenics and stuff. Ev, are you still here? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm
still here. Oh, okay. Yeah, and you want to give Judy some more information about yourself and our listeners?
Well, I just want to give some information. I'm the better-looking guy.
Okay. Ev, you want to go?
You can. She can Google me by just typing Ev Hallford, H-A-L-L-F-O-R-D, and listen to some of the interviews I've given recently and on eugenics and other topics. And I don't have a website yet, but, you know, I'm hoping to put one together at some point.
Okay.
Okay, and John, you want to tell her about yourself real quick? You got 9 minutes.
All right. The my website is just JJ Alishauskas, which is JJ Alishauskas at yahoo.com. I don't use it very much.
That's your email address. Email.
That's right. Email address. I'm not much of a computer person. I don't get much time to get on it. I got 9 kids, and it's just hard to stay alive. They're because I talk as a whistleblower, I get persecuted pretty hard, and they keep me running. So I got touched by God here back in 92. I had a 10-ton bulldozer fall 10 feet and hit me from my neck to my ankles with a roll cage. Track stood in the air and blew my head up like a balloon about 8 inches diameter, bigger than what it normally is, which is huge. And to look at me today, you would never know I was hit, but I was able to see hell. I was able to see heaven. And he gave me the task of finding truth and reporting on it, is all I can tell you. And it's been kind of an interesting ride.
And, Judy, like I said, we got into a little spot there, but the thing is that, again, folks, she has some information and facts that are undisputable, you know, for what happened there on September 11th. And I would say please go to her site because it's amazing the amount of material she put together, over the course of the years here. And it's a very good forensic trail of, finding out, what it was, what the outcome of 2 alleged planes would leave, which made no sense. And it couldn't have been 2 planes. It had to be much more than 2 747s. And again, if that is the fact, then the 747s can be used, Judy, as a very good weapon, I would say. I mean, if they are able to
get that special magical fuel and sprinkle it on buildings that you want to destroy.
Yeah.
And just disappear, right?
Yeah, I mean, they need to go buy bowling. They don't have to make any more weapons at all ever again. Just use bowling planes.
Control demolition is or us, firm, and just sprinkle this special jet fuel on buildings, and poof, there they go.
Amazing. And this storm thing, too, have you seen anything weird with these storms that we've had recently? This last storm that hit Texas, does that show another one of those patterns?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's plenty of weirdness there. It doesn't surprise me at all. I was focusing on Aaron, and it's interesting that the eye of Aaron is shaped like a pentagon, and it looks like worms in the middle. It's not a swirl pattern. It's a, those big hedge mazes that they have. It looks like that inside. Big rows, big zigzagging back and forth maze kind of thing.
Well, what caused that? Have you determined what that?
No, it just doesn't look like a hurricane would look like that naturally.
That's amazing. Well, I thank you very much for coming on the show, and I thank you for your work, and keep up the good work, and anything we can do to support you, please let us know. Love to have you back on again. And also, Ev, I thank you for coming on as well. A lot of good information.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I thank you for sharing your information of being in New York at the time. And John, wonderful questions. Thanks. And we're going to be back here tomorrow morning. We have a program called Devotions, and it's going to be on in the morning, and we'll be back at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time at night for 2 hours. So I welcome everybody that listened tonight, and if you want to contact the show, it's 630-666-8528, 630-666-8528, and go to my website, which is deanneburleyshow.com. TheAnnBurleyShow.com, or go to phone, phoneshow, show.com. You can also get me on KU-band on satellite. So good night, everyone, and thank you for tuning in, and thank you, everyone, for coming on board, giving your information and opinions. Good night, everyone. And
good night,
and
thanks, everybody, and God be with y'all.
Good night.
Thanks.
she